Hi everybody, hope you're well. My name is Jim Carroll. Welcome you to the weekly podcast from the Banter team. If you're interested in Irish pop culture, and Banter certainly is, you will have already come across Brand New Retro, the site which has curated and digitized thousands of images, articles and adverts from an ever-growing archive of vintage Irish magazines and publications from the pre-internet age. To coincide with the publication of a new Brand New Retro book, Brian McMahon, Joe Collins and Sinead Kinney from the site joined us to talk about Irish pop culture over the last few decades.
Hi folks. Welcome along to Banter here at MVP. This is Banter number 122. My name is Jim Carroll. Like Factory Records, we keep an account of every single banter we do. So this is the 122nd. No, actually, yeah, it is 122nd banter we've done. So welcome along to MVP. Glad you're all here tonight. We celebrate the launch of this particular book. Nearly. It's called Brand New Retro, and it is about vintage Irish pop culture and lifestyle. And we're joined by the three people, I suppose, who are most closely associated with the site over the years. On my immediate right, we have Brian McMahon, who basically is the founder, the instigator, and the main man behind the whole thing.
That's right, Jim. Yeah, it was myself who started the blog and brought it through, and I brought in Sinead here is my wife. She would have helped.
So Sinead, you'd no real choice in this, did you?
No.
did you have any objections as the project went on?
Well, what could I say? I didn't, of course.
Okay. And then Joe, I mean, like you're basically coming from a design background then.
Yeah, I work in advertising, and I've done design for 10, 15, 20 years. So I would have been friends with Brian for 10 years, played football together, five-a-side, messing. And we would have, it was just one of those things that we were in the pub one night, and we started talking. I was moving jobs, and I decided to get a book, my portfolio made into a book. And I found this pages online, you can get them done. And I said to Brian, you know, this is what, you know, direction you should be going. And he was already thinking about it. So it was just being friends and then working together. It was kind of quite adaptable. It was quite good, you know.
Okay. I suppose let's go right back to you then, Brian. Let's go right back to the start. I mean, it's kind of funny. You showed me the book earlier on. And when I wasn't looking at old vintage copies of The Enemy on all the shares out there, I was looking through the book. And there's a photograph at the very, very, very back of the book. Hang on now. This is why you need Madonna-like microphones. Hang on, Sinead. There's a beautiful photograph at the back. This is a photograph of your family.
That's right.
From 1964.
Yeah, this photograph
Was this the first photograph on Brand New Retro?
It was, and it was the first photograph I actually scanned. I actually never done scanning before, and it's a small photograph, just, you know, the size of an iPhone or a little bit bigger. And I scanned it in, and it was a eureka moment. I scanned it at a high resolution. It looked big. I look beautiful. My parents look fantastic. And my dad had just died, so it resonated with me. And I put that. I said, this is it. I put that at the banner, and I knew it was onto something, although I had nothing else up.
So before that then, what were you doing? I mean, were you a magazine collector? Were you kind of like, are you someone who was obsessive about magazines and pop culture in general?
I love pop culture. I wouldn't say as obsessive as magazines, yes.
You weren't obsessive?
No. I am now, or I have been for the last 5 years. But it's interesting, when I was dating Sinead, I'd always meet her either at Easton's or at Tour Records, because she'd be late and I could hang around the magazine's stand and have plenty to do. That was the moment when I knew to start it. But before that, I had been involved with fanzines in the late 90s with my brother Raymond. We did a fanzine called Too Late, which was about it was influenced by the punk DIY ethos of fanzines at the time, and it soon grew into sort of a lifestyle fanzine about, you know, the young male and female in Dundalk at the time. And I always thought, you know, we need to digitize that. If you look online, there was nothing about it. I was also in groups. I was in a few punk and post-punk groups and electronic groups, and there was absolutely nothing online about us. So I said, I'm going to have to rectify that. But of course, I did nothing. Until my dad died, until I got that photograph, and that's when it started.
Okay. So talk to me about, like, I suppose the first couple of weeks and months in a Brand New Retro. What were you digitizing, and what was getting the most traction and most reaction from readers, and how were those readers finding you?
Well, the first couple of months it was very personal stuff. I said personalized the fanzines I did, some of the music I did. So there was very little traffic, but I wasn't really worried about that. The main thing was just to digitize my own personal content. But I have to say, some friends, some of them in the audience here, one person said, who's going to be interested in that? You know, why bother? But some of our friends were fantastic because I'd be boring them about my times in the past, about in groups and stuff like that. And but I never actually showed them anything, and I never actually played them anything. And then this was an outlet to do that. And I have to say, they were great. They gave great positive reaction, and that spurred me on. And then when I realised that other good fanzines like Heat fanzine and even more mainstream magazines like New Spotlight and that had no online presence, started scanning those, and that's when it kind of went a little bit wider. And I was going for a few months. It was great fun. And then I think about August of 2011, I think even yourself, Jim, Broadsheet, picked up on something. And then, hey, I started getting a big audience. And I was lucky that I had a collection of previous posts. So at that stage, about 50 posts. You know, and I never thought of sending out, publicizing, sending something to Broadsheet or sending something to people. People came to it. And it kind of, that worked out well. It was better because it gave me time to establish my own groove and my own skills. Because if you look at the early stuff, they're all scanned crookedly. There's shadows on them. And, you know, so I developed my skill over those first few months.
So let's talk to Sinead and Joe then about, like, I mean, you're very, obviously very, very close to the site, but by virtue of, like, I mean, you know, living with the bloody site, you know. So it's like, what was your take on it at the start? Did you see this as kind of a hobby gone mad, or did you see some kind of, like, I suppose, historical or some sort of, like, I mean, way of documenting things that was going on with the site as well?
Well, in the beginning, I thought it was something mad. I think it was untapped grief, maybe, at that point. So I didn't really understand it. I could appreciate his fanzines because we had always looked through them and had a bit of a laugh about them and everything. And I agreed because with him being in the band, I had gone to RTÉ and tried to get his footage of him on Young Line with Connor.
Choice,
yeah. Yes. What was the name of the guy? Connor. McAnally.
McAnally.
And Orty didn't have any of those kind of archives or anything, and I thought, well, that's a bit of a pity. So I appreciated where he was coming from and he was trying to put it all together and everything. But it took a while for me to really figure out, or to realise that it was quite big, actually. Yeah. It was just like, we only have one computer in the house.
And, and it was constantly, scanning. It was
constantly scanning, and the scanner made a lot of noise in the beginning. It was kind of a very old one, and it. So there was a lot of, a lot of work being done that wasn't involving anybody else.
Okay, so Joe, like, I mean, you knew Brian from kind of being football. At what stage did you realise he was doing something like this? And at what stage, what piqued your interest about?
Well, like I say, I would have been, we had on a mailing list, Brian would have, that those first personal images and whatnot. I mean, he sent those around and absolutely sort of, so they were very striking, amazing. And I was just like, keep encouraging. I mean, it grew steadily in his own by adding himself. I got the links and of the latest updates. I suppose what appeals to me is that there's so much of it that is, like, a lot of it, the lifestyle chapter in the book is Irish advertisements, and that kind of resonated totally with me. And it's just sort of fascinating to kind of step into sort of what was in the country, how exciting or maybe how really boring this country was 20 or 30 years ago.
So looking back then, and this is a question for all three of you, was the country a boring place from what you can see from the magazines?
Well, I lived through it, and essentially it was. We I've no doubt we now live in the best of times, I think, in Ireland. I mean, I come to this pub tonight, and, you know, the music beforehand was fantastic. You know, music that I was listening to back in the 80s and 70s, and you just didn't hear anywhere. It's you know, it's...
You were making the music, Brian, as well, at that stage.
Yeah, true. But, no, back then, I mean, it's very much, it's not the good old days at all, it shows that, but it does show there was some fantastic work, whether it was in advertising, design, music, that is really well worth being revisited, and most of it now, the best, is featured in the book. So, you know, it works both ways.
I mean, do you think it's the case as well that, like, you know, I was saying this to Joe earlier on, when it comes to magazines and when it comes to, like, I mean, things which document particular scenes, you always need a head the ball, you always need a Madzer, you always need a Maverick to run the magazine, to actually kind of have that kind of vision. As you were kind of, I suppose, finding these magazines and bringing them out, did you find that was the case? Did you find there was various Mavericks in charge, and what they were doing, there may have been, well, there'd be people in London and Paris and New York doing something similar, but there wasn't something in Mullingar doing it.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, one in particular was John Cochran from New Spotlight. It was a mainstream magazine, and it was a lot about the show bands. But he came from Cork, and he got a magazine going weekly. Eventually, started off with monthly, and there was some great stuff in it. You know, there was Pat Egan, who's still going, Donald Corvin, who's no longer with us, and the great articles about the beat scene and the underground. And they were small, but. You know, if anybody, I think as well, like, because we're involved with fanzine production, we appreciate that the work that goes into a magazine and to get it out every week with no, you know, modern day cut and paste. It's just fantastic. And when I was growing up, I knew Spotlight and I didn't like it because of all the show bands in it and it was terrible. But now when I look at the stuff from the 60s, I think it's fantastic. And there's some great stuff in it.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, this is more from, kind of, supposed from an advertising point of view as well. Like the changes in terms of Irish culture over the years that the book covers as well. I think as well, like as kind of Brian was talking there about, like, I mean, the show bands and that. There's a great article that Paul Tarpey, who's a Limerick lecturer and a journalist, wrote has been written about the kind of like the evolution of the Irish dance scene, you know. And like I'm looking through the book and I'm thinking that a lot of the things he's talking about are reflected in that. But from an advertising point of view, do you see kind of like much kind of changes? And do you think that what was being done in terms of Irish advertising at the time of, say, the 60s and 70s, was that, like, I suppose, reflective of what was going on elsewhere and internationally?
I would think so, but, I mean, a bit like you might see today, and I see it in today's current climate, that the budgets are bigger in London and, you know, the photographers are better and whatnot and there's sort of more money pumped into it. But regarding advertising, like, back in the golden era, I suppose, the 60s, 70s, what we're missing now is we don't have the cigarettes advertisements. And that's where the money came, you know. I mean, I can even within the book we have a page of cigarettes, and you can kind of see there was a bit more money to spend. We were a little more creative, and I suppose in today's world of advertising, people putting a poster or a flyer together, we can just go. You can go to Shutterstock. You can get an image for if you're a butcher, or you know, you can get a photograph and download it and just stick it up, and it's, you know, it's a reasonably well taken image, yeah, and you can use it, and you can make a flyer really cheap look smartly, where that facility wasn't really, I don't think it was there. So it was kind of, there was a big gap between those that had professional photographers and those that obviously didn't have any photographers, so they would illustrate stuff. There's a lot of stuff that's sort of
hand drawn,
yeah. Like there's suits and all sorts of, like, men's clothing is all illustrated, like it's by pencil almost, you know. And that was a resource they in the book, it's quite clear they went to, you know. But that's a, you wouldn't get away with that now, you know.
Well, you wouldn't away, because I mean, like there has been, a revival in some ways of illustration. You know, it's interesting that, like, I mean, that back then they were obviously doing it because they couldn't get access to kind of like high quality photographs, you know. So they got someone out who could actually draw and bring them in and do that.
Well, it's funny, yeah, because at the moment, you know, I see the style at the moment is that sort of earthy typographic sort of look, you know, and you can't have a craft beer, you can't do organic product packaging without your hand drawn. You know, typography, most of which is actually fonts, and so they're actually, if you look at fine two characters, they're actually identical, so they're not really hand-drawn, but they're made to look it, because that's the digital world we live in. So I was just looking through the book there last night, and the only example of hand-rendered type in the book, because everything else just seems to be font-based, is actually fonts that are trying to look futuristic. So it's almost the Space 1999 type that is what is the hand-drawn. And there's only a handful of examples. So, like, there's all this sort of, oh, the typography today is very retro, but there didn't seem to be... What is in the book doesn't represent any of what is going on at the moment, to what we call or look to be as retro typography.
But is that not the case? This is a question for, like, all three of you. Is that not a case then that maybe back then magazines weren't retro at all, because it was all about the future? I mean, if you're trying to be retro, you're going to look back to the 1940s, 1950s, and imagining an Ireland in the 1940s, 1950s in any way with kind of any kind of nostalgia is completely wrong, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Definitely. Like, there was very little to look back on from in Ireland anyway. And Joe's right that the fonts, They're all futuristic. They're all great, though. And I mean, and there's a mixture of them. You'll see them all, various types, and they're all fun, though. They're all good.
Well, yes, but it hasn't changed. You know, in some ways, we're still using the same fonts today. You know.
Hmm. Well, one thing you said on in the interview with kind of Luke McManus on the video online, a plug in the book, you were talking about like the fact that like years ago, you know, magazines were very ephemeral. You know, they appeared and a week later they were gone. People were quite happy to throw them into the bin. Mm-hmm. They were quite happy to kind of just ignore them. Whereas with a book, you wouldn't do that. It's interesting, you know, like when Joe mentioned the digital age there, I'm thinking like a lot of magazines which exist now online, they'll be online forever.
They will, yeah. And that's great. It'll be easier to store and to preserve.
And you can retire then.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely, yes. They will, but again, the whole thing is different, though. I mean, when the magazines were coming out, it was the only source of news. You know, I bet you know this. You know, there's the enemies. And by the way, people in the audience, the enemies, if anything you see, you feel free to take it home. If you go home and you find something that's of Irish interest, please let me know. Yeah, but you know, they were like, I mean, I couldn't wait till Thursday when we got the enemy and to go through everything. It was the only source of news. Like nowadays, tomorrow, the Irish Times, the ticker will be out. And you know, to think that something like the ticker was going to be in the Irish Times 20 years ago, there was maybe a little section about.
There was one page. There was one page. Yeah, once
it's changed so much, you know.
That's the editor of the Irish Times getting on to explain. That there was actually, we used to cover every single music going back 20 years ago.
You know, yeah.
So in terms of like me, I suppose the magazines then, which kind of resonated with you as you were doing your research, all three of you, like what magazines stood out for you? I mean, what magazines, I suppose, gave you like surprises that you weren't expecting?
Oh, yes.
Man Alive.
I knew one of you.
Come on, Sinead, tell us more.
Sinead, tell us more about Man Alive.
She doesn't let me put in the nude pictures.
Tell us about Man Alive, Sinead.
I'm not really sure what Man Alive is, actually.
It's an Irish playboy. If you look at the first issue or the second issue, yeah, it's got a profile on Mary Robinson, for example. So,
not that
it's
kind
true.
Of profile.
And we're going to give away a copy of that tonight for you people in the competition. So it's very rare. Man Alive, yes. Man Alive was Aaron's first magazine for men. Sophisticated gentleman from the age of 25 to 35. I remember that magazine actually when I was a kid. You know, it was one
from
of the
where?
Few things you could get. you know.
Was it your dad's?
Pardon?
Was it your dad's?
No, it was a dentist, I think. You know?
So I'm looking here at a double page spread of Man Alive covers. There's six of them in all, and they feature ladies in states of undress. I suppose best describing it.
Photographic essays.
Yeah, photographic essays. They look like early Sunday World photo spreads.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Actually, I think there was a connection with the Sunday World subsequently, or Kevin Maron, for example, was involved with that.
Yeah.
Who went on to work with the Sunday World.
And there's also kind of like feature just so people don't think the likes of BuzzFeed and Vice come up with mad features. The feature here from Man Alive in 1974 of a gentleman streaking down Wellington Road on a spring day.
It's fantastic. That's really clever. They've managed to capture not only the nudity, but a Dublin bus sign or a CIE and an Irish telephone box, which is great. You know, when you want.
Okay. Ooh. So besides Man Alive's coverage of Mary Robinson and streaking in Dublin 4, but not at the same time. Just so that lawyers listen to this will note. What other magazines kind of stood out for you?
Well, I remember Heat magazine was a fanzine that existed in Dublin in the late 70s, and it was really, really good. Jude Carr and P. Price were the guys behind that, and living in Dundalk and getting this fanzine that was talking about the groups like the Radiators from Space and just being so stylishly laid out. It was handwritten, but the handwriting was good, and the graphics and the drawings were superb. And I was amazed when I started doing it that none of that was online. I just, my God, none of this is online. And then when I started scanning that in, that really appealed to people with a graphic sensibility as well. So I'm kind of, there is pride in sort of bringing that to a new audience, a Heat magazine. And then I discovered a magazine. There's a Scene magazine that came out in the 70s, but there was an early version in the 60s, and it's amazing. I'd love to get more copies of that. What bits and pieces? There is this also in a religious magazine, and you talked about maybe an editor being pretty maverick or whatever. It's called Irish Spotlight. I'm going to confuse now. It's nothing to do with New Spotlight. Irish Spotlight, and the priest or whoever, the Dominican who was editing that, he was good. He this was his vocation. He shouldn't have been in the priest. He should have been an editor of a magazine. You can see it. It's so obvious.
What book, what would you, Sinead, what magazine stand out for you?
Woman's Way, Woman's Own.
Way.
Woman's Way. No, I wasn't. Sorry?
Yeah, the problems.
Oh, and the problems, yeah. The problems were always very, yeah, they stood out. They were always very sad, very heart-rending, and, yeah, awful. They were an insight into really where, I mean, your fashion pages and your advertising could be fantastic, but when you read the problems, you realise that's actually where we were at, really.
And, like, I mean, were the problems that, like, readers were writing in about, like, were they the kind of problems that, like, I mean, are still here around today? Or, like, I mean, was it reflective of different
Ireland? I hope not, actually. People thinking that they could get pregnant from French kissing and French letters. And there's that new spotlight that she's in, this woman who's adamant the whole way through that you can do anything you want as long as you're married.
Yes.
And it was kind of, it's uncomfortable because there was people writing in saying, I French kissed, and French kissing is for married couples. And you're like, ooh, wow. And heavy petting, that's for married couples. So you could kind of, you could do nothing, but when you got married, you could do whatever you wanted. And it, like, so people in Ireland got married to have sex.
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting. Like, basically, the problem pages reflected really what was going on.
Really, I'd say, yeah, really what was going on. And I mean, unfortunately, the information was awful. And as Brian says in the book, you were either going to be told to ask your local priest about it or buy the certain book in Easton's where they would explain it. And there was absolutely no information for people, particularly for women. And this woman was, she was very down on women as well, if they're carrying on with fellas.
But that's, it's really interesting because, I mean, like, you know, you would expect that a woman's magazine would actually be a lot more sympathetic to those readers.
I think that one was New Spotlight, though.
Yeah.
Mostly.
Is that the religious?
Yeah.
And she wasn't too fanatically religious. She was just kind of all about getting married and then carrying on whatever.
She probably ran a wedding band. Joe, what about you? What magazine stood out for you?
Well, just bear in mind, I suppose I'm coming from the design side, and I, like Brian's viewers online, only get to see snippets of the magazines. You know, Brian just puts in scans. He doesn't, you know, the whole magazines don't go in, just articles that are interesting. So that's the way they kind of come to me. So, but certainly from looking, going through the book and of the stuff he came through, there's one magazine called Status that struck a chord, and it was a ladies, well, it was a news magazine for women set up in 1980. By the background came from McGill, and Marion Finucane was the editor, and it actually lasted 1 year, which is sort of sad. And it's sort of publication I don't know if you'd ever see again. It was very political and very strong on the on women's libs. So it was a very brave effort. But again, I talking to Brian about it, I perhaps it was let down with just advertisers didn't get behind it, right. You know. And so that's sort of, there's an interesting kind of thing going on there, that in many ways we look back at Brand New Retro and go how things really were, you know, they were a bit lost, but in other areas they were really trying to be quite progressive, and maybe would scare us today how progressive maybe our how you know, forward thing they were. And then I just have one note of a small advertisement we have in the book. It's for Brighter Homes in 1980, and it's in the RDS, and the headline talks about seeing Gay Byrne's living room, Valerie McGovern's kitchen, and Larry Gogan's leisure room. So, you know, I'd love to see Larry Gogan's leisure room now myself. I'd say it's changed now.
But what's also interesting from what you've just kind of, like, the advertising there for Brighter Homes and from all the other kind of bits and pieces in the book as well, is that back then we were still using celebrities to sell. You know, this whole idea that celebrities are being used to sell magazines and products is something new. It's rawmation.
Hasn't changed, to be honest, Jim. Yeah. Hasn't changed. You know, as I say, some things just haven't really.
Absolutely, yeah. There's loads of changes.
What has changed, though, is who the celebrities are, isn't it?
Larry Gowen. Mike Murphy.
Yeah, those celebrities actually worked as well.
Yeah.
Compared to our celebrities now.
I suppose the other question has to do with as the site grew in, I suppose, popularity as well. I was getting to kind of wonder, like, you know, would I, like, obviously you're putting digitized, you're digitizing stuff which isn't digitalized at the moment. You know, this is stuff which is kind of from the pre-internet age. But, like, you know, one thing about publishers is they're fairly keyed in when it comes to legal stuff. Do you get any kind of approaches from publishers, kind of going, take that down, or kind of like looking for a slice, or looking for some money for using something that's maybe from 20 years ago?
We've never had one request to take anything down. And I think that's down to our reputation. You know, the site's been going for almost 5 years now, and we've always done everything with respect. In other words, if there's an item I've scanned, first of all, I only scan it if it's not already on the internet. We will give the credit to the source, the photographer, the magazine it came from. We'll even say the date the magazine issued. So if someone did want to go and research it further, they may find it, say, in the National Library or somewhere like that. So the reputation, and there's no advertisement on the site. Having that time on the website made it easier to get, say, copyright clearance and permission to use them in the book. Because you could approach someone and they explain to them. And in most cases, people are happy that their work that has been long lost or long forgotten has suddenly been rescued as such and is now getting a shop window on the site and now in the book. So it's been great to see that. And most of the magazines as well are long gone. You know, most of them, I think there's a handful, maybe three or four still going, like RT Guide, Woman's Way. And again, they were great, you know, they kind of worked well. They can look them at the site and see its reputation. We showed them the cover of the book because we shot the cover way back in April. And, you know, I think they felt that we're going to be part of something special and therefore were happy to give permission. Also, a lot of the stuff in the book and on the site comes from New Spotlight. Pat Egan wrote for that. And about 2 years ago, Louise Coughlin and the Coughlin family got in touch with me, and I said, oh, here we go. This is it. But Louise was fantastic. She was actually, her dad had just died earlier in 2013, and she was very proud to see his legacy be carried on. And she was great. And I remember, actually, when we were talking about the book, I said, I need to talk to the Coughlin family. And I put it to them, and I told them what we were trying to do. And when I remember the moment I got the email back saying, great, go ahead, guys. Yeah. And I knew we had a book down.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I often kind of wondered about that, you know, because it's like someone like them, you know, that magazine plays such an important part in terms of, like, the social fabric of this country. Like, I remember talking to my folks about this, and, like, you know, that it would cover the show bands, it was the kind of, like, it was the hot press, it was the 9 on 9 of its day, and, like, you know, now, like, and the fact that it's been forgotten about, you know?
Yeah, and obviously, you know, they don't have the resources or the manpower to have an archive and to do it. So when someone comes along with a real interest and passion to do it, it's I think to appreciate that. You know, so, but yeah, you're right. I think back in the 60s, you know, to do that weekly, started off monthly, did it weekly, and got great stuff. Like, it's a great for, like, there's pictures in there of Thin Lizzy or Phil Lynott. And, you know, as a young musician starting out, you need encouragement. You need some kind of acknowledgement. Mm. And that magazine gave him that and other artists and led them to go on and grow.
Mm. From is it from?
No, well, just I know when we started kind of talking about the book and how we were going to put it together and compile it. I mean, we worked very blind for the first little bit, and we had to acknowledge: is it going to be stories in it or not? And like, what are the chapter breakdowns? That needed to come from both of us. You know what I mean? How it was going to happen? But it was one of those things that I was itching to kind of say, why don't we just throw a little joke here on the bottom? Or, you know, there's so much funny stuff going on. But I think Brian was right all along, and he kind of maintained it with that. He wanted it to be kind of serious, almost. And as well as when I went to the comedy is in the actual
art. Absolutely.
You know, the fun is in what you see. Yeah. And it was when I came to Brian with a couple of layouts, a couple of ideas, and maybe how the book may work, I did kind of give him an option of, like, the Shamrock, you know, on the front cover.
And comedy version.
Yeah, like, sort of a play up on the eras, you know, but... he himself was adamant that he wanted something a little cleaner, and I think that's what it does, is trying to let the artwork inside, do the talking.
There's massive respect for the work that's there. So it was a just that was the rule. Treat it with respect and present it in the nicest way possible without kind of modifying it, and make it part of a beautiful sort of time capsule of Irish pop culture from the 1960s onwards, and hoping that anybody who's in it feels proud to be in it.
All three of you have kind of like talked to us about the evolution of the content, the evolution of like what these magazines were covering and what and how they covered it. What about the actual kind of design point of view as well? I mean, I'm curious about this. You talked earlier on about the hand illustrated stuff. You know, this being kind of like the Irish Year of Design, for example, is there a clear Irish design ethic to these magazines, or is that complete nonsense? Is it the fact that you can't actually make out a clear design narrative?
What I've seen, I don't know if there is a design movement, that would happened like that. I don't think it was, I don't see it anyway. I think we were, sort of seeing what everyone else is doing and sort of copying it a little bit, no doubt. And it was the same with music, even you think how the show bands operated. I mean, they just played hits of what was going on in the charts and Luxembourg or whatever, the BBC Luxembourg. And I suppose that's, and it still happens today, you compare yourself with what's winning awards or what's in and layout and whatnot. You do start what you go to, you see the ID magazines, the UK magazines, and I don't believe there was a
but there's a definite trend over the decades. The 60s was the illustrations and it was clean and it was good and it was exciting. It was obviously in the UK it was the whole free love thing, which I don't think fully hit here. But I think what it shows, well, like under the surface, there is always something good there, and discovering some of the magazines now, you can see that. But 60s was clean, but then come the late 60s, the early 70s, it gets cheap. The paper gets cheap, the design gets cheaper, and it's not just one or two magazines, it's a trend through them all. And then into the 80s, desktop publishing a little bit comes along and it gets even worse, I think. There's loads of text on colour backgrounds or an image in the background where you just can't read it. They can't even scan it, and you don't want to read it. It's madness. I don't know. And I said this to my brother. He says, "Oh, maybe this was just a mistake." No, they did it for months, for years. So at some stage they had this thing where it was cool to put text on an image or something, and you just can't read it. You don't get that today, really. I mean, do you get the odd design thing where people are going with design and it's very hard to read the font, but I think usability certainly come more into the fore now, but back then, God, it was some terrible stuff. And I still hate those 70s ones because there's probably a good story there, but you can't even read it.
Do you think that what you described there is that cheapness, was that kind of like a case of cutting back costs, or was it kind of like a encapsulation of the age that the 70s were plastic?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer. I don't have the right answer. My own view on it is that maybe they got tired of things a little bit. You start off in magazines and it really did start coming in the 60s, and you talk about this and that and everything, and then you start repeating it. And then you went start off as monthly and then you go weekly. So you've just got less, more to do, but less quality. And whether, I don't know if the troubles in the north had anything to do with it either, but that's, obviously the late 60s as well. But maybe maybe paper, even the paper sometimes got cheaper, and it's not as nice. So,
was there a pop culture scene in the north that time? It's funny. I was looking at the site, and I was just kind of like I was looking at some of the comments some readers left, and some reader was attacking you on the about page back in the day, kind of going like, "There's nothing. It's all here about Dublin and Dundalk. There's nothing here about the north. There's nothing here about the Irish language." So it's like I'm curious. Let's leave the Irish language to one side. Yeah. From the north, was there a pop culture scene in the north?
Of course,
station?
Yeah, there was. There's a pop culture scene everywhere. There is, no matter you're Tipperary, yeah? So you're there, Jim. So there's a pop culture scene. Even if it was you.
For me, there's not.
Well, there's two people, there's a scene, right? But, no, there was
just, there was just me,
yeah.
Brian.
Yeah, okay. I saw that comment. It was great. I loved it because... but the thing about Brand New Retro, the website and the book, is it doesn't set out to be the definitive collection of anything. It's really what I can get my hands on. I'm making the most of that. I do have a lot of alternative also, the fanzines, for example, but they were already scanned. Somebody else had them up. So my view on that was, what's the point of scanning them if they're already there? That is a true ethos that has worked well. I remember at the start of the fanzine, somebody said, "Oh, why did you just take this from this website and do this?" And I said, no, why? You know, and okay, it means more work. It means more noise in the kitchen. It means more going up, and but it's worth it. And so the Northern Scene, yes, there are a few things. Pat Jennings, he's from Newry, he's in the book. The biggest hands in soccer. Martin O'Neill,
George Best in there as well.
And Sinead Cusack. And that's a great thing. I was talking to Alan Amsby today. He's going to launch the book tomorrow. He's Mr. Pussy. He came from London via Belfast in 1969 to Dublin, and he was Aaron's first drag artist. He's launching the book tomorrow night, and he's been living in Dublin ever since. So I showed Alan the book today, and he was loving it, and I showed him, yeah, you're on page, whatever it is, 99. But he's flicking through, and he just flicked past the sport chapter. There is a sport chapter. But then he went back to it, and there's, oh, he saw Sinead Cusack in there, you know. And so the sport chapter is very much about the lighter side of sport, the entertainment style of it. And I can't remember what the question was now, Jim. I'm way kind of way off.
You managed to talk your way around it. Question to do the pop culture scene in the North, and was a magazine. So the pop culture scene in the North was demonstrated by Pat Jennings' hands and George Best's nefarious activities. Let's talk maybe a little bit about like some of the magazines that have got away. You know, are there magazines out there that all three of you kind of like wish there was more of? You know, you said earlier on that like only two magazines that still exist. Sister, the RT Guide and Woman's Way. It's like, are there magazines which got away? I mean, you talked about Stasis earlier on. You know, I mean, like, are there other ones which kind of like you look at now and think like, Jesus, why didn't they get more traction at the time?
At the time, like now, obviously they're gone. Like the Enemy has been given out for free in London and on the streets, tube stations. Yeah. At the time,
There's certain magazines I look at, kind of like me, say, like in Dublin. I don't know if in Dublin it's still going, but in Dublin,
no.
If in the last couple of years of his life, it was a horrible, tawdry thing. It was terrible. Yeah. But like when it started out, and like during the late 70s, early 80s, it was a seriously good magazine.
It was,
and it's kind of magazine you can imagine becoming like a Village Voice or becoming like one of those alternative, or cut from similar cloth. You know, are there other magazines like that that like you know that had great potential but just didn't make their way out?
Well, I think Scene magazine, the one I referred to earlier from the late 60s, I said I discovered that one by accident. I found it actually online, and I just was blown away by it totally. The production values was great photography in it. On the cover, there's actually an illustration by Jim Fitzpatrick, and inside was just very high quality values. So it was way before our time, but certainly one worth checking. Gary, don't go chasing it now. That's Gary O'Neill in the audience there.
I wonder if, like all projects, and you know, we talked about magazines being set up by Mavericks, and you know that you know it's so intense, and you know there's such good intention, and the first couple of publications are great, but it's very hard to keep the momentum going. Yeah. You know, and keep the level up and keep the stories going. You know, it's. I think it takes a lot of effort, you know.
You said earlier on there, like, I mean, I'm just thinking what you said, Joe, about like, I mean, designers and like, I mean, main designers were kind of like copying or like, I mean, be influenced by what has been done elsewhere. You know, I mean, like, I know, kind of like, I mean, writers, kind of like, I mean, we kind of stick together and we know who did the stuff back in the day. In terms of designers, do you know the magazine designers from back then? I mean, what are they doing now? Has anyone tried to reach out to them and see where they are? What
no, it would all come through Brian, but I wouldn't. No,
you might know the advertisers maybe or someone, the agencies there, but. Yes, I do. Like, and it's funny. A lot of them have got in touch with people who are involved with them, illustrators. A lot of them are now in the States or in Australia. The Heat fanzine I talked about, Jude is in London, and Jude Carr, that's Eamon Carr's brother, and Pete, I think, is in London as well. But you know, there's some great stories from there. They do get in touch, and they said, "Do you have this issue? Do you have this thing? I did this illustration," and. They're delighted when they get it. So, a lot of them have passed away, sadly, too, like Donald Corvin, you know, great writer.
One of the pieces which kind of jumped out at me recently on the website was I referred to this one to you in an email. It was like Gabe Byrne writing about Stiff to the Fingers. You know, as you're kind of like putting the book together, did you come across other like odd juxtapositions like that?
Yeah, they're great ones. That because I held on to that Sunday War for some other reason, and then I just found it at home, and I went through it and said, "Oh, hey, great! There's this." Now, interestingly, I think the one of the writers of the Sunday World was also Stiff Little Fingers' manager So it was, you know, a little bit of probably...
Payola.
Yeah, exactly, going on there. You know, whether Gay wrote that article or not, I don't know. There was the other
are
one...
Are you throwing shade on Gay Burns' Stiff Little Fingers fandom?
Not at all, no.
There's great images of Depeche Mode sitting in a pub. Madness in Madigan's.
Yeah.
Having a couple of pints of stout.
Specials in Colony Station.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, they're kind of when the sort of the English groups came to Dublin, those photographs I think are really good and special. Yeah.
Rod Stewart walking down the quays.
Yeah, and then Moore Street.
And Moore Street, surrounded by the locals.
They're great.
So are there any magazines you're looking for? I mean, you said earlier on before we were talking that most of the magazines come from your own private collection. You haven't got many contributions in from people. Are there, like, I mean, and obviously, like, you know, you're going to flea markets, you're going to secondhand shops, charity shops, trying to find as many out there. Are there any magazines which have eluded you? If you're going to throw a call out for them, what would they be?
Well, yeah, some people have been great and sent stuff in. It was great. I hadn't got all the slates, and a friend around the corner, Kate, gave me a lend of a few of those, which were great. The slate's not in the book, though. I'm afraid I did a cut-off point of mid-90s.
Which leads the way to a second book.
Actually, interesting, if there's any younger people than me here today, there is definitely, what is very popular is stuff from the 90s, and I don't have an awful lot of that, you know. And, you know, that is pre-internet,
Just about pre-internet. I mean,
yeah, it is. You know, but it is. Like, or even you say pre-internet, it's still pre-broadband. You know, like, stuff didn't really go onto the web until, and you could see it, but I'd waiting for ages to come down until about 2005, you know. So, and, you know, obviously, you know, what amazes me is that the younger people do like the blog and do like the site and will like the book, but they don't know the stuff from the past. So, like, I know when I was younger... I hated the 60s at the time. I was bored with all the people going on about how great I was and everything, you know, and so anything in the past I didn't like. So it's great to young people dig what's here. But
they just want to see what their mammies and daddies
are doing. Yeah, but, you know, the people maybe now in their 30s or 40s, stuff from the 90s, and I think there would be a bit of a market for, you know.
Okay, so that sounds to me like you're talking yourself into another book, another project.
Not for the moment, no.
Cool. Have any questions from the audience? Any questions from the audience about the book or the site or about, like, mean Irish, I suppose, Irish pop culture from the 60s, 70s in general? Just put your hand up. And don't be scared. Jesus, great.
Actually, just one of the take there was Brian's sort of sending me the scans of, like, what he was thinking to put in the book. And I was able to, you know, obviously they came up in Photoshop and it was sort of a bit of retouching, and I think it was all done by hand. I mean, these lines were all sort of gummed down and whatnot. And I remember seeing the frame of an ad and sort of all these sort of... I was able to line it up so neatly. And I noticed that the inner line was all crooked. And it took me ages to figure out why the feck was this line crooked and it wasn't. And it just dawned on me that it was obviously stuck down crookedly. And it was just one of these things that, like, something that we can't get wrong today is draw... Like, it's so easy to draw a square. It's very hard to get a square or a straight line wrong in desktop publishing today, you know, and it's sort of the art of just being crooked just is gone. Yeah,
that's pity.
There you go.
And the other question then relates to the book itself. I mean, you know, obviously at some point someone kind of pointed out there's the stuff of a book here. You know, at what point did you approach publishers about it?
Joe, I'll let you tell this one. I think we approached them. You go ahead, Joe.
Well, it was what happened was that after putting my portfolio with Blurb together, I went off and did a prototype with Brian after agreeing a couple of layouts. So we had this 50-page kind of mock-up of what we thought the book might lead to. And it was kind of, you know, it's hardback. And we thought we'd sell it in to the publishers that way. And but then we had this hardback book, but then we didn't know how do you can't knock on the door of the publishers. You have to kind of introduce yourself. So I got one of the posters on the wall there of a box of chocolates advert, and I just replaced the branding with kind of brand new retro and printed it out very large and sent it to five publishers that were targeted, and we kind of didn't hear back from many of them.
No, two. We got an instant response from three.
Instant response from three. It was but they weren't.
Did you choose any particular weekend to send these out?
Valentine's week. They got a big surprise. They thought they were getting something special in the post. It was a big, where is it? Yeah. So you get this in the post on Valentine's week. What do you think? So, and
we got none of them back, put it that way. In fact, yeah. one of the publishers who didn't want to run with the idea of the book said, you know, they all liked it, but said it. Yeah, it's the poster. Yeah, it's hanging on my wall. He said, yeah, yeah. We weren't getting them back. But we've managed to get one of them back, Sean from Liberties, this evening. So, then we met two or three, didn't we? Yeah. And we met Eric, was it? And some of the publishers are kind of set up for this sort of book, others are not. Yeah, and it's sort of, you sort of learn your way. And as much as Eric from Transworld liked the book, he was like, my sales team wouldn't be able to sell it. They just don't get it, you know? So
it's interesting, you know, we were talking about this earlier, and not just because Gary's in the audience, we were talking about, where were you, and we were talking about, the fact that there is a market now for these books. There is kind of, a situation where people do want to find a way of remembering that past, especially remembering that pop culture past. You talked there about young people like Brian, and being interested in the site, maybe because it's what their parents were about. But, a lot of young people are very interested because of the history of pop culture. And pop culture is still one of these kind of new things that they're trying to get their head around. And the fact is that pop culture did exist in Ireland in the 60s and 70s, and something like this book is bringing it out.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think pop culture is great, and it's also, it's sexy, it's visual, and, to me, I was surprised actually nobody had gotten in touch about a book, really directly, you know. I thought, hey, there's a great book here.
I think, to be honest, no, that says more about the state of Irish publishing than it does about the size.
Okay, thanks, Jim.
That's what I was supposed to say.
It does make it's the thing about the book as well, and pop culture is there's variety. You know, it goes from fashion right through to design, advertising, to music, and lifestyle. So the variety is great. It's and that's pop culture as well. You know,
I pay my TV license and whatnot, and there's what sickens me is when RTE start playing these reruns of things you've already seen and over again, and but there's one show that actually I don't mind watching again. It's Reeling in the Years, and I just love I listen to the music, and I love the current affairs that goes on, and you know, like that, it's serious and then it's not serious. And I think what Brian is sort of he's creating is kind of the page 7 and 8 of that, and you know, and sort of it's the inner story of what's going on behind those big headlines and those big chart successes and that sort of music, you know, and that's why I think that's what it appeals to me, you know.
But what's also doing is kind of providing a true line, you know, and I think something that's very, very important, because especially we look back in our history here, we're very good at looking back kind of the social stuff, the economic stuff, the politics of it, the serious stuff, but sometimes what you see in terms of what's in an ad or what's being advertised says more about what people were going through than anything else. You were pointing out to me earlier on, Joe, you were pointing me out the cigarette ads, you know, and I was just and the drink ads as well, you know, and some of the drink ads, Jesus, in an era of kind of gender equality, there's absolutely no way a county executive would go for some of the drink ads that are in the book, you know, a woman, I can't remember what the tagline was, I'm looking for, Jesus, that was the 70s, you know?
Or 80s, I think. Well, no, it was late 70s.
Yeah. And there's another in the book is there's a campaign for Dingo's jeans, mm-hmm. and they're incredibly risque, you know? I mean, there's... And you're sort of, they're very bohemian people. There's definitely a couple of bit of wet t-shirt sort of thing, t-shirt going on with the ladies, a lot of nude painting going on. And you're sort of, you're kind of, the doobie must be left of centre here. And these jeans were made in Louth, you know.
But it also kind of shows you as well, when people look at, say, Mad Men, they look at the shorthand of what Mad Men is about in terms of, received glamour and things like that, and, the smoking and drinking and shagging that went on, you know, that had probably disintegrated in 1970s in Irish advertising world to advertising Dingo's jeans and doing some risque ads for beer involving women, you know?
Yeah, I mean, but there's definitely the bit of sexism is definitely creeps in, you know what I mean? Within the publication, I think that's, and it was just the way things were at the time. I mean, that was perfectly acceptable. So we look back at it now, and it, you know, so there's a competitive book Saatchi is bringing out now, which is politically incorrect advertising. He's publishing a book at the moment, and I'm looking forward to seeing that. But it's just completely politically correct, you know, wrong advertising, and it's scary, you know, how some of it comes across, you know.
Okay.
But and most of the ads would be sexist in those magazines anyway, all the way through. There was a lovely one about, what did she give him? A book token? And or he got a book token? He gave her
for
a book
Christmas,
token
yeah.
for Christmas.
Yeah.
And he was going to get laid that night because of that book token. What? And all the ads are all as well for getting women little cookers and things are making their life easy by having them. And I suppose they had to advertise to the person who was going to use the cooker the most in those days. But they're very sexist, most of the ads. And I mean, the women all have half pint glasses in them if they're in the ad for the drink.
I know as well. I mean, they're like, you know, there's no way on earth you can imagine like Joe, a kind of like a client pitching into a meeting looking for something like that now. Or it's been tolerated.
Yeah, a brave client. Or a brave one. Never say never. I mean, I'd love to get my hands on it. You know what I mean? That's a brief. Yeah, but no, you'd kind of fear for a company that would try that now. I guess maybe it's
for the better.
Okay. Before we get to kind of competition and giveaways, any questions from the audience? Yep.
I was going to ask the great thing about the site is that it's obviously curated. It's obviously there's thought behind it, and I've kind of got two parts to the question. One is, do you actually have a plan about the kind of things that you want to specifically put on the site? And the other part of that is, do you ever feel, I'll just scan every page of New Spotlight and put it up because somebody's going to want to see every page?
Mm. The second part of the question, no. There's because there's loads of issues of New Spotlight that I haven't even touched a page on. You know, so, and going to the first part of the question, yes, the creation, it's obviously, some stuff just jumps out at you. It's just fantastic. It looks great. And then other times you might be looking for a balance, you know, that maybe you've done a lot of stuff from a particular magazine, you need to vary it around. I think the site is a bit like a magazine, you know, when you open it up and you're looking maybe for the sports results, but before you get there, you see another story that gets your attention and you pull it into it. So it's, you know, it tries to appeal to as many people by putting as many things. But ultimately, I've scanned so many stuff and I put it up and I have a post ready to go and I just say, oh, that's not good. It's just, there's nothing there. I thought it was good. And then sometimes something that looks just all average and then you scan it and, as I said with the picture of my parents, sometimes it just comes to life. You know, so scanning is good. You know, it can transform the analog or the paper into something really exciting. Thank you.
Yeah. Any more questions?
It's just a similar question. Did you feel you had a sort of responsibility that you were creating an archive, even give a view that particular period that maybe younger people, did you feel sort of a responsibility to sort of have some kind of balance in this archive?
Responsibility, I think, be more just, as I said earlier, to the source material. You know, if there was something I thought wasn't representative of what it was, and it might have been a cheap laugh or something, I wouldn't put it in. You know, if it was out of context, whatever, sometimes.
And I know, Brian, when going through it as well, you'd always keep an eye out for a location or something that would tie it into, you know, that was always very important to Brian. I was like, well, I'm not seeing the appeal. What's so great about this ad? And he goes, well, that's City Hall in the background there, you know, and that's, so that gives it a location. And that was sort of, that's sort of something Brian sort of does tend to go for. It may not be necessarily the better photograph, but it certainly might have just the more contextual and more Irish based. Mm.
Did anyone else try and, I suppose, do something similar? Was there any attempts made to kind of like have a brand new retro tube on anyone?
Brand new retro tube?
Another site, that, like me, I suppose, taking the same source material.
Oh, using the material I had?
Similar idea.
There's no brand new retro equivalent in the UK, is there?
There would be similar sites internationally, but I think the most of them do kind of just take it from the web and curate it from going around to the web and taking stuff. Don't know of anybody who just exclusively goes out and scans stuff. There's another woman in Dublin who does something, she's killing me now for not knowing the name. I think it's Lady Jane. But she does international magazines, you know, and she just scans them. So, but no, I don't know. There are loads of sites, and you see them now, historical pics and all that, but they're just taking pictures from here, there, and everywhere. No, not aware of any others, Jim.
Cool. Do you want to give some magazines away?
Yes, as I said, the magazines are on your seats there. Feel free to take them home. There's some good stuff there, I see. I kind of regret leaving some of them out. But we also...
Do you want to grab some of them, take them back?
No, it's okay. It's okay.
Sure.
Yeah. Listen, I'm sorry we don't have the book tonight. I know some of you might have come to look for it. It's not going to be arrived till tomorrow. And through Magazine Factory and Fashion. And also, Jim said earlier on that... But this is 122, you know, the factory record thing. We went with Liberty's Press for this, and I did like their independent label spirit. That did attract us to them. And even the factory, I think of the Peter Saville poster for the first gig or the first record. I can't remember. It arrived the day after the gig actually happened. but it was beautiful, you know. So I'm hoping that doesn't happen tomorrow.
So you said you've got some rare magazines you want to give away.
Yes, I have three magazines. I think they're just here. And the aforementioned Man Alive is up for grabs.
Man Alive has disappeared.
We also have a copy of Jump fanzine, which is from 1984, from my hometown of Dundalk, which my brother did. And the other one... They're somewhere, yeah.
When we were finalizing the...
Man Alive has been found.
Yes.
And the third one is the slate, you know. So the last issue ever, and it says, a special souvenir edition, throw it away as soon as you've read it. You know, which... inside, no boring listings. Just made up rubbish from start to finish. You gotta love the slate. It's great.
You gotta love the slate because the people who were behind the slate were really smart. They're two media operators now. One of them, John Byrne, I'm fairly sure. He worked in News Talk and then he moved to Canada. But the other guy, Hugh Ormond, became a producer in RTE, producing Marion Finucane's show. He's also behind the Halls Pictorial Weekly, and he's also behind Second Captains as well.
Oh, that's fantastic. It's amazing, actually. People who worked in fanzines have gone on to fantastic things like Tony Clayton Lee, Arthur Matthews. Lots of other people are involved in Almost Nudes. It's all in the book. So, okay, we've three magazines. Slate, Man Alive. Yeah. And Jump. This is a pure fanzine, handwritten, stapled together, produced by my brother and myself and some friends back in November 84. Okay, Jim is going to call the first person who get the first question. We'll give the user or the winner the choice of which magazines they want, and Jim is going to call out a question.
Oh, okay. There's a headline here in the Slate, and it's Muller Mike strikes again. And who do you think is in reference to? Basically, this person went and slipped through a disastrous raft of anti-drinking laws for Ireland. Yep, who said that?
Very good.
You get a copy of the Slate.
What was the answer, Jim?
Michael Martel.
Oh, very good. Okay. Oh, no, do you want the slate or do you want Man Alive? Or do you?
Sorry. Do you want a copy? Do you want a copy of the slate, Man Alive, or Jump?
Slate.
So do you want Man Alive? He wants Man Alive. Yeah. Give that man Alive. I'll give it to him. And then Brian will ask another question.
Okay.
Next question.
Jim, you're going to get a question.
Okay, next question. We've got two magazines left to give out. One of them is the slate and the other is... Jump. And the question from the slate is... I know. I'm trying to think. Oh, yeah, okay, no.
I've got one, Jim.
Great.
You can take it. This is... Okay, next question. This was a review of 1984. And the best TV programs as identified by Jump magazine was The Young Ones, Bilko, Coronation Street, Brookside, Star Trek, Minder, and On the Ball. The question I have for you is, who played Bilko?
Phil Silvers.
Gentleman in the front here with the beard. Do you want the slate or Jump? Hey, well done.
No one wants a slate. Right. There's Ned on the back here for The Darkness playing in Vicar Street on October the 2nd, 2003. For those young people in the audience, Darkness were a weird band. Name one of The Darkness' three singles on the album Mission to Land. Yeah. One more here.
Hello.
That's it. That's all we've given away. We've got chocolate. There's loads of brand new retro chocolate at the door. Please take a bar, would you? There's Tunnock's tea cakes here as well. Please take one, which as well. Any more? Finally, any more questions from the audience? Or are we all okay?
Just one last one.
Yep.
Just when you say you've got into scanning, do you just mean like on a home printer?
Absolutely. Yeah. I started with a 3-in-1 printer that cost €30, and I did nearly everything right up until we started the book. When unfortunately, I had to rescan everything. At 600 DPI for the book, and that was difficult because I had to rescan, but I also had to go and find everything
in the attic.
In the attic.
How long does that take?
That took. I know Sinead went away on holidays, and I said I'm going to be working on the book, and she said great, I have a week for my own, and she came back and says, what did you do? And I looked and said, what did I do? It took ages, Jim. And
when
then a lot
I
of
found
stuff.
You, I said, what? When I waded my way in, what did you do?
It took a matter of
weeks. Well, it was hard. See, at the time, I didn't really have a really disciplined archive practice. You know, I'm much better now, but so I had to go and find everything again. And I couldn't find some stuff, and there was a bag of stuff I couldn't find until the very last night.
Yeah.
And we were going to the printers. We had a big night ahead. Audrey was helping us with Joe. We were just proofreading, and I arrived down with about 10 more scans that I wanted in the book for Joe.
They loved you.
Well, that was probably the only time we ever kind of there was a little bit of tension. But in fairness, Brian was doing it for the right reasons. There was no falling out. He knew this was going to make the book better, so there was no complaint.
Okay, cool. That's great. Please go out and buy the book. Buy a copy for yourself. Buy a copy for your friend for Christmas. Buy a copy for your mother and father as well for Christmas. It goes on. It'll be on general release next week. They're launching it tomorrow night in the Workman's Club. If you fancy going along, have more Tunnock's cakes and more copies of Man Alive. But I'd like to say a huge thanks to the three amigos from Brand New Retro, to Joe, Sinead, and Brian. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim.
Thanks to Brian, Joe and Sinead for their time and contributions. This podcast was produced by Banter series producer Tanya White. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please rate us and spread the word. Tell your friends about us, recommend us on your favourite social media network, leave a review or a rating on the iTunes store, and don't forget to subscribe. Check out thisisbanter.com for news of all we're up to at Banter, plus you can also listen back to all the Banter podcasts to date. We'll be back next week with another podcast, and until then, goodbye and take care.